This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
What is Dax, are you?
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker on all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all, so we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge, trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
Joe Tooney of your Chicago Bears. I like saying that. It's fun to say. I wonder how they feel in Kansas City about getting just a fourth-round pick next year for the multi-time Pro Bowler. Let's ask Danan Hughes, shall we? He is on Twitter at TheHughesGuy83. He is the Chiefs Radio Network analyst, and he joins us on the Score Hotline, brought to you by Circa Sports Illinois. Download the Circa Sports app today. So what do you think about this deal?
Yeah, I think you got to look at it at multiple sides. Obviously, the business of the NFL can be ruthless at times. It never fails when you start to think about all the details of what we're dealing with Joe Tooney, being a guy that's creeping upon the mid-30s, 1 year left on the contract. Done an outstanding job. He was the team MVP this season, voted internally. And he's one of the more pleasant, down-to-earth dudes. And you guys will appreciate that in Chicago, because if you've been around NFL locker rooms, heck, any sports locker room, there are guys that you can approach. There are guys that you have to walk gingerly towards. And then some guys, I think some people may just have to avoid. Joe is a guy that you can always approach. You know, for me as an analyst for the Chiefs Radio Network, I go into the locker room, I interview players after games, wins, losses, etc. He's always accessible, always personable, and he knows how to have that light switch. I mean, you have to have two sides of the coin to be in an NFL and to be a dominant player like he has been. And for a guy to be as ruthless on the field but as personable off the field tells you about his professionalism, and then his resume speaks for itself. So I just know, I've been around the business. I was a rookie in 1993, has been a part of the NFL in some aspect from a broadcasting standpoint since I left the game in 99. So I've seen this story before where – There's players out there, teammates that have an allegiance to you. And, you know, in one side, they say, you know, we hate to see him go. But at the other, on the other side, you recognize that it's the nature of the beast.
And I know that football games are not won or lost with somebody's character. However, I do think that it's important, Dana, that he reportedly brings an even character and an appreciated one and somewhat of a unifying one. In a Bears locker room, though, I wouldn't say it was necessarily lost or splintered, but where we heard a lot of players speak out in the media about how they didn't like the direction the team was headed in. You know, it resulted in, obviously, Matt Eberflus getting fired, but I think somebody like this would be a really stable presence. Playoff, obviously, experience, all pro. You know, the resume that he has speaks for itself when it comes to being respected and what he's done.
Absolutely, 100%. I totally agree. He has that contagious attitude, that infectious kind of character that you want to see. You know, when you talk about a team that hasn't really performed up to standard, when you talk about the Bears, and then you see, hear about the fracturing internally, you need that stabilizing force. And I think Joe Tooney has shown throughout his career, whether it was with New England and then here in Kansas City, he knows how to be a champion, he knows how to be professional, and he knows how to be a guy that guys can rally around. He's going to be a guy in that locker room that's going to be like, dude, stop complaining. Let's just go to work. You know, it's not that bad. Let's go to work. We got a job to do. And that's where you need those kind of forces. Yeah, you can have the outspoken voices, and you need a complement of that. But you also need the guys that's just going to get down and dirty, be a gritty team player, and comes in with the resume that he has, a four-time All-Pro, four-time Super Bowl champion. I mean, what more could you ask for if you're trying to stabilize your offensive line and be that force? I mean, he has more. I think I read something where he has more first-team All-Pros than the entire Chicago Bears offensive line since 1990.
Are you surprised? Are you surprised it only took a next year's fourth then?
To be honest, I am not surprised in this business at all anymore. I mean, nothing fails to shock me. The fact that you're talking about, from a player standpoint, you know, if you're talking about Mecole Hardman, if you're talking about maybe some of the local Kansas City media, you'd hope for more because of his resume, especially with what he was able to accomplish this past season with moving from the guard to the tackle position when we were desperate and how he fared out there on the left tackle position. But from a business standpoint, look at the numbers, look what you're freeing up. You recognize that even though you're looking to ship guys off like Joe Tooney, other teams are recognizing that you need to ship guys off like Joe Tooney. So there are teams out there that are not going to break the bank for you from a draft capital standpoint because they know you have to unleash somebody that's going to free up, what did I saw, 12 to 16 million in cap space. Like, so the supply and demand is a factor. You'd like, because of how he performed in Kansas City, you would have liked to get more. But you can also understand the business that with 1 year left, he's going to have to redo a contract or get a new contract in Chicago. Nobody is going to break the bank for him personally when he gets to that destination and then also open up the bank for you to take some assets from them or more assets from him by trading him. I've seen a lot, so I'm not too surprised, but I will say we lost a great one, one that will be in the Hall of Honor for the Kansas City Chiefs in the future.
Okay, so you talked about Tooney playing obviously both guard and tackle this past season. I'm just curious as to what you thought about the way he played tackle and how much he can help a team in a pinch if they need somebody with some versatility, because we know what his reputation is at the guard position.
Being around the NFL, it's always about the more you can do. And there's no better example this past season than what we saw Joe Tooney and what he was able to accomplish. It wasn't just that he was serviceable out at the left tackle. He was strong. He was dominant. You can probably say he was one of the top 5 or 10 left tackles in the league when he played there. That just tells you about his makeup, his work ethic, and his attitude and his approach. So, like, if you're a teammate you can't help. See, there's some guys, being in that locker room, there are some guys that you can't help but work harder because you're working alongside. And I think that's what you can see when you talk about Creed Humphrey, Trey Smith, who they are franchise tag, and that's part of the reason why they were open to letting Joe Tooney go, because you can't have that much money tied up between your two guards and your center. But from a tackle standpoint, I think if you're Ryan Poles, if you're the Chicago Bears, you are happy to get an all-pro left guard, but you also know in the back pocket that if things go awry and there are issues that come up, which at times they do, you can move a guy out that's versatile enough to play the left tackle and be a Band-Aid, a really, really good Band-Aid for you while you go through that adversity.
And Dan, and that was something that I was thinking about in all of this, was you knew, given Kansas City's cap issues, once they decided to franchise tag Trey Smith, that somebody was probably going to have to go. Was this a thought? Did Tooney cross your mind, or did you have other people in play that might also be casualties?
I think the key word in that question is once, or the key part of that question was once they franchised Trey Smith. Prior to that, I thought maybe they could figure out a way to keep all three, or maybe even allow Trey Smith to go out and be on the free agent market. But once they franchised Trey, I knew that it was only a matter of time that Joe Tooney would be expendable. And you also have to realize with what the Chiefs have done in the past two drafts, we look at the bright, shiny coins of the Xavier Worthies and the Rashee Rices, but we also used up early capital on offensive linemen in Wanye Morris and Kingsley Suamataia. And you have to try to figure out, you can't just ship those guys out. You have to figure out if they can be serviceable, if not at the tackle position, maybe at an interior line position. So it sounds like Kingsley is going to have an opportunity to earn that left guard position. And then now that opens the door for them to go shopping on the free agent market and get a left tackle, which was desperately needed. So I don't know how many times you can go early in the draft to the well of offensive linemen and not utilize them. So getting creative with Kingsley and figuring out what they're going to do with Wanye, who they moved to right tackle for a little bit at the end of the season as well, trying to get some mileage out of those guys, is part of the reason why they felt like they can get rid of Joe Tooney.
I think it's important what you said, and we played the Tooney comments after they lost the Super Bowl, and that was my first thought, was there he is. Like that, mm-hmm. the fact that that's the guy who is there and standing up and is there at his locker or available after a loss.
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking, well, with the Chiefs, that's really not all that often, frankly. I mean, some of the Bears teams I covered, that was every week, and you knew who those guys were by the end of the year. You talk about how it reveals character, but it's one thing where the team almost never loses.
Yeah, and it tells you a lot about his makeup and how he can be an effective force and leader in an organization. And how rarely do we say that a left guard can galvanize an organization? But I think Joe Tooney has that makeup to do so. And you think about when we got him, we were reeling. We went and played in the Super Bowl against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. We were exposed because of injuries at the offensive line, and Patrick Mahomes ran backwards and sideways for, I believe, 498 yards in that game, running for his life in that Super Bowl. And we got blown out. And immediately, Brett Veach went to the market and said, you know what, we got to fix this. We got to get this fixed, and we're going to make it happen. And they did that with the draft and Joe Tooney. And it equated to three straight Super Bowl appearances and two Super Bowl wins. And you got a lot out of him from not just a winning perspective, but also from a leadership perspective. So I feel like, you know, this is the nature of the beast in the business side, but at the same time, you recognize how great Joe Tooney has been for this organization, the success that we've experienced because of players like him. You wish him the best. You just know that this is just part of the business.
I also then worry, because when Brett Veach decides to part ways with somebody, you wonder why. And this is no shade on Joe Tooney, but it's a fair question given their assessment of talent and timing. Yeah, what do you think about just the way that Kansas City has been able to do that so well?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, here's part of it is that if you were shipping him to someone who did not have history and experience with the Chiefs organization, I think that could be a valid question. But Poles came here from Kansas City. He knows the inner workings of each player as well as how the organization works. So for that trust level to be heightened as it is, I don't think there's anything to really be concerned about. I mean, he finished the season. He's been an Iron Man since he's been in the league, started 146 games of 146 games. Like, I don't think that there's really any meat on the bone there in regards to concern. Now, anything can happen. I mean, we've seen that with L'Jarius Sneed. We've seen that with other players that have departed. But I don't think there's anything to be worried about at this point. I think he can be a staple of your offensive line from a leadership standpoint and production standpoint.
Danan, I have to say you sound a little overall disappointed in this. And for whatever reason, I kind of like that.
Oh, man.
That makes me, I'm just being honest, it makes me feel good as a Bears fan that you're a little let down. I wonder, though, had the Bears not made this trade, would he have been waived? Is it possible he could have been signed as a free agent?
Yeah, I don't know with the salary cap hit that would have been taken. I don't know if that would have been the casualty factor in it. But I think this is a graceful way and a respectful way for an organization and a great player to kind of part ways. So, yeah, I am not happy about it at all. I mean, scrambling through the locker room, as you mentioned, leading into this interview, that we hadn't experienced very many losses. So to go into the locker room at times when we have lost, looking for guys to speak to who are not going to be giving me one-word answers or be difficult interviews was a rarity at times, but Joe Tooney always stepped up to the plate. Very respectful, eye-to-eye communication, handshakes, very personable. So, yeah, it is definitely, when you lose one of those type of guys, it's definitely something that the Chiefs kingdom will feel for some time, but you recognize that We got to make something happen, especially with the way we lost that Super Bowl.
$16 million hit, by the way, this year,
yeah,
which is a lot less than the $26.9 million of last year. Just to me, this is real simple. He's the older player between him and Trey Smith, so you keep the young guy. I mean, that's kind of how I saw it, Dane. And is that the way you're looking at it?
Yeah, I think so. And then also, if you would have gotten some mileage out of Wanye Morris or Kingsley Suamataia at the left tackle position and you didn't really feel like you had to address that, then maybe you could figure something out with Joe Tooney. But now with the holes that need to be filled at that tackle position, I just don't feel like you would tie up as much money into the entire offensive line as you would have had to if you kept Joe Tooney. So, yeah, once you got Trey Smith, I think that's a component, and you franchise him for sure. But if you had the luxury of having a right tackle and left tackle starting based on drafting them in the last 2 years with Wanye and Kingsley, I think you could maybe make some concessions at the guard position that might have kept them.
Danan Hughes, thanks so much for popping on to talk about the news. We appreciate it.
No problem.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. Indeed sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/listen. Just go to Indeed.com/listen right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/listen. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
And now, two pigeons who can't believe how good humans have it with DirecTV.
These humans are hopping from streaming apps to live sports without batting a wing.
All from the DirecTV home screen.
With just one click, you could be watching a baseball game, a movie on Netflix,
or a critically acclaimed documentary.
You watch documentaries?
I love the ones that leave you with a question.
What?
Exactly.
DirecTV, a better way to watch whatever you want to watch. Visit DirecTV.com.
Internet-connected Gemini device, separate Netflix membership, and additional paid subscriptions required for third-party apps.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code FLEX at checkout. That's harrys.com, code FLEX. Enjoy.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Casey, how are you this morning?
Good morning, guys. Happy Friday.
You called your shot yesterday with the Bulls. You kind of knew what was coming, and I guess Orlando now 1-6 at home in that 7-game homestand. Rare you get a 7-game homestand. Rarer still that you can't win more than a game. I mean, awful.
Yeah, 5 straight losses to close that, including 2 to Toronto Raptors. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what prompted me to say that on the pregame show that the Bulls were going to win, but I got one right. But I will say I didn't expect it to be via Kobe White's 44 points. So there's always a game to be played and a result to be analyzed.
So what do the Bulls have? What is Kobe White to the NBA? What do they have in him? Because he is capable of doing what he did last night that was a career high. But last year without Zach LaVine, he thrived. This year, Zach is gone, and you can see these kind of moments, these bursts of – he's streaky. He is what he is. I guess I'm wondering, at this stage of his career, what is he to you?
Well, I mean, he's clearly a guy that will give – I mean, cliche alert, but he'll give everything he has to try to help win. I mean, that's just – he changes role. You move him on the ball. You move him off the ball. You give him an ankle injury, he'll play through. I mean, the guy is just a competitor and always plays very hard and tries to impact winning. You know, is he a lead guy on a championship team? Probably not. But, you know, he's a really, really good player. I mean, he showed this all season last year, obviously, finishing second in the most improved player voting. He is a top most opponents scouting reports now defensively, especially with Vucevic out. And he's playing at a very high level, and you have to give him all the credit in the world because, you know, he played at the level he played last season on the ball, and then what do the Bulls do? They trade for Josh Giddey and move him back off the ball. He's just constantly had his role adjusted here in Chicago, and he's always found a way to still make an impact.
There is no getting by the fact that the Bulls seem locked into that 10th seed. It seems like they're definitely going to be in the play-in. And I get it. I understand why people aren't happy about it. But when you go 2-9 and you don't pick up any ground at all, it just means there are teams determined to lose out there. And we know who they are. There are certain teams that look like they've already quit, and there's not much the Bulls can do about that.
Yeah, and players are and coaches are always going to play to win. I mean, you saw that the other night, citing this Toronto-Orlando epic matchup again, where Toronto pulled its starters with 9 minutes left, and then their reserves win on a last-second buzzer beater. So,
You know, players are going to compete. To me, this season was defined and kind of sunk, if you're in the tank camp, by that 18-20 start. I mean, that's, you know, that Nolan, I didn't have them going 18-20. I mean, and at that time you had Zach LaVine telling me, you know, if they keep us together, we can be a playoff team, not a play-in team, a playoff team. Well, they didn't keep them together. They traded Zach. They tried to trade Vooch. And here we are. But, yeah, it just seems like the play-in berth is kind of the new number seven seed, as I told you guys. You know, it's like a number seven pick of the draft. I mean, the Bulls seem like they were stuck on the number seven pick of the draft for years. Now they seem like they're stuck in being a play-in team perpetually. And we'll see what that costs them, you know, as we see the play-in play out and also the draft lottery.
Zach Collins did not have a great night, fouled out, and probably had his worst game as a Bull, but he has been impressive, KC, before last night. He has been a guy that had the defensive presence and was getting double-doubles. And I'm just curious, when you envision, you know, the offseason and you look ahead, how does he factor into the plans if he does at all, or do they know yet?
No, I think he absolutely factors in because he's insurance for Vooch because he signs for next season. Now, you absolutely will have to believe the Bulls will try to reengage on trade talks for Vooch, considering they held those leading up to the deadline. I'm not sure what kind of market Vooch is going to have this offseason. But if you are able to engineer a trade, you know, you have Zach Collins projected to be the starting center, and I think he can handle it. I mean, when this guy is healthy, he's typically played at a pretty high level. Now, you mentioned, you know, the rough game last night, but what I like about him is he reminds me a little bit of Vooch just in this sense. He's a really cerebral player, smart passer. You can run offense through him. He's much more physical than Vooch, not as skilled as Vooch, but and can't shoot it like Vooch. But, you know, he's a legit seven-footer, and he's very physical. And he just sees the floor very well. I mean, I remember noting that dating to his days at Gonzaga. I watched him in the tournament that year. And, you know, he...
Wait.
Yeah, I watched the tournament.
You watched the tournament that year?
Yeah, every once in a while I watched March Madness, okay?
Okay.
And I watched Cooper Flagg once to see what all the fuss was about. I told Kendall Gill I watched the blasting of Illinois, when Duke blasted Illinois.
Oh, boy.
So ouch.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah. So every once in a while I'll watch a college game, but very rarely. I think Zach Collins, his big problem has been not being able to stay healthy. And now that he's healthy, you can see what he can do on the floor.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, the Zach LaVine trade or salary dump, whatever way you want to term it, that ended up maybe a little too good, right? Jones with 20 points, 5 rebounds, 4 assists. We've seen Kevin Huerter being able to play. It just looks like they may have gotten more than they wished.
Well, I mean, to the tanking camp and the fans' perspective, yes. But this is my point. This is how management operates. They don't really fully want to, you know, totally tank. I mean, they you saw that last summer when they targeted young players with experience rather than like raw 18, 19, 20 year olds. I mean, that's kind of been their MO, is to always have a modicum of competitiveness. And to your point, you know, Kevin Huerter's on a career-long streak of 6 straight games with at least 3 three-pointers. I think we need to rave about Trey Jones a little bit. I've been really impressed with this guy. Forget the counting stats last night. Just his IQ, his ability to organize on the offensive end. And then defensively, I thought he had a monster game last night. He was really responsible in a lot of gaps, came up with a big steal late. He is undersized, but he just knows how to play. And that's kind of what jumps out to me about all these guys, Huerter, Collins, and Trey Jones. You can just tell they know how to play basketball. Like, and the way the Bulls are trying to play, moving the ball side to side, sharing it, you know, high assist team, high IQ team, they fit right into that. And I think that's why their assimilation has been so seamless.
When you think of guys like that, and I know exactly what you're describing, guys who know how to play, guys who are, you know, quick to assimilate into new systems because of that, How do you describe Dalen Terry's role in this organization and this plan moving forward? Because There are times, Casey, without being unkind, I think you wonder, does he know how to play? Does he know where he fits? And what is his role? Because it seems like there are some athletic moments, and then there are other moments where, boy, is he careless with the basketball, and is he in the right spot? I just don't know what to think of him.
I think that's very fair. What I would say is two things. I mean, he obviously had that brief experiment starting a couple of halves recently, and obviously the game in Indy on Sunday, he started the first half, Trey Jones started the second half. That was actually more for matchup reasons, but he didn't do much in that first half in that opportunity. I do think the one thing about Dalen Terry is if you throw him out there like 5, 6, 7 games in a row with like decent minutes, you know, 14, 16 minutes, he does kind of seem to me to have like a cumulative power and effect to his game just because he plays at such a high, like he competes so hard and he's got so much energy defensively. He's long, he gets deflection. So it's not a lot of stuff that's going to wow you in the box score. But when he does get consistent minutes over a longer stretch, you can see the potential there. The problem is he still has, you to your point, David, he still has too many stretches where he just does head-scratching things, and that's why he doesn't get a lot of those long stretches of consistent minutes. So I can't figure him out either. I can say that, you know, those other guys obviously are a little bit more established in their NBA careers, and that's why Billy and the coaching staff are leaning on them more. Yeah, he's a tough one to figure out for sure.
Josh Giddey with one assist away from a triple-double. You know, we keep talking about it. We've been talking all year about wondering what they're going to do at the end of the season with him. And, you know, he's a solid player and a young guy, you know, needs to protect the ball more. But I feel like he's part of their future. Am I wrong?
No, he is. And the way he's playing now, it's going to make it even, you know, easier to bring him back. I'm sure you guys have said this too. Like, the thing that I keep saying and I've been told is their thinking is like they just can't repeat the Patrick Williams mistake. They can't proactively bid against themselves. I mean, there are very few teams with cap space this summer. Make them go get a big offer sheet and then force you to make a tough decision. If you are never faced with a tough decision, play hardball with him. And if he doesn't like it, have him play on the qualifying offer and then see what happens. You know, it's like, I just think you got to have him back at a responsible number. But yeah, I think really since the day he was traded for, you know, when you trade Alex Caruso for him, that's just not a player that you're probably going to let walk unless it gets really untenable. And the way he's playing now, and again, the counting stats are one thing. I just have seen, you know, he's always been a good rebounder because he has really good positional size. I've really been impressed with how aggressively he's been rebounding in traffic of late. I mean, that I know he's done that at times in his career when I would catch him in Oklahoma City, but I think he's doing it really consistently, number one. And number two, I think he's competing much harder at the defensive end. Not to say he's perfect or, you know, shutting guys down, but he's just competing harder. So those are the two things that kind of jump out to me with the way he's playing right now.
19 games left. What are the pros and cons, risk reward with getting Patrick Williams back into the lineup or onto the floor?
Well, I think he'll play. I think there's a good chance he plays in Miami. Kendall asked me last night, like, do you think they're going to shut him down? I haven't heard that one time. The pros are he's young and had another season impacted by injury. You got to get him out there. Another pro would be to get him looks with Bouzelas because that's kind of the projected starting forward tandem for your future. I mean, he's signed for 5 years. There's not going to be a trade market for this guy this offseason. So he's here. So that's those to me. I don't see any cons. You know, if he gets hurt, he's got all offseason. I don't want to wish that on anybody. I'm just saying if he gets hurt, he's got all offseason to address that. So I've never heard one inkling of shutting him down. You know, we talked to him briefly coming out of halftime at the Cleveland game. And, you know, he talked about this being the window of availability opening for him on this trip. So if he gets through today's practice in Miami, I'm not there, but if he gets through today's practice in Miami without incident, I would expect him on the court tomorrow in Miami.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that, you know, who knows? It just feels like they're trying to – you know, they're trying to win the way they claim they were going to win, right? Their ideas. Yes. So why not load up as many of these guys? And as you say, what's the downside? I mean, it just feels like everybody is kind of, there's an inevitability to them as a play-in team. You know, it's nothing you can do but embrace it and move on.
Yeah, so they're 3.5 up now with 19 to play. Yeah. I haven't looked at tiebreakers yet. I mean, I'm not going to scoreboard watch that closely for a play-in seed, but they're 3.5 up with 19 to play. And if they lost again last night, you know, both Brooklyn and Philly lose, so that they would have kept a 2.5 game lead. I mean, it's like they can't help themselves. So at this point, you're going to finish 10th. You know, get out there, get the guys' experience, play for next season. Hope for some luck in the draft lottery. I mean, the draft lottery odds to me have pretty much sailed. So you just got to, like you said, Mully, kind of embrace it and move on from here.
So when the Cavaliers passed through the United Center the other day and woke up in the fourth quarter and decided they were going to actually win this game and win it going away, did you feel like you were watching an NBA champion? Do you think that the Cavs have had the kind of year that reminds you – I don't want to say – I don't. The way that they are so complete and so deep, you know, you think about the Bulls Eastern Conference final runners up when they had, you know, that kind of depth on the bench. They had a star. They were making the case for AK when he talked about having, you know, 6 to 8 to 10 players you could count on, and yet they have a star in Donovan Mitchell. But when you see, I was curious, KC, when you see the Cavs doing what they're doing, what do you see?
I mean, those are great points, and all I can say in general to that is I keep the soundbite I keep saying to people is like, let's just get to the Eastern Conference Finals. I mean, how awesome is Cleveland versus Boston going to be? You know, assuming they both stay healthy and get there, man, that is just going to be an epic series. I see what you see, David. I mean, they're just really well constructed. They've got a star, you know, not the level of Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown star, but pretty damn close. They've got size. I always value size in the postseason. They've got depth. I'll tell you what, everyone talks about the DeAndre Hunter acquisition, and I loved it. Obviously you can see them trying to load up on wings for that Boston matchup. I think the Javonte Green acquisition that flew under the radar was massive for them. I don't care if that dude plays 10 or 12 minutes. You saw it in Chicago. He makes winning basketball plays, and he came in that brief stretch and had that had 6 points in that like a 14-0 run that completely changed the momentum of the game. The guy is just smart. He's athletic. He's tough. He plays bigger than he is. There's another body they're going to be throwing out there in that Boston series. So I thought, to your point, the depth in that Javonte Green and DeAndre Hunter acquisitions were – really bodes well for Cleveland's postseason run.
I saw some of the highlights of last night's game with the Lakers against the Knicks, and the Knicks, Jalen Brunson injured his ankle in that game. But that was a couple of ex-Mavs going at it. And, I mean, the Lakers they really are a different team and maybe a significantly better team with Luka.
8-2 with Luka.
Yeah, I got home from doing the post-game show and turned that on. I was just going to watch a little bit, and then, of course, I ended up watching all the way through overtime. So, it was one of those regular season games that just kind of pops out at you. First of all, it was incredibly physical. The refs were really letting them play. Really, really physical game. Gabe Vincent hit some big shots for the Lakers. I'm still not sold on their depth.
Yeah.
But – and I just, to me, and I haven't watched a ton of them, but I've watched a decent, I've probably watched 3 or 4 handfuls of games since Luka's arrived. And I know they're winning, but there just still seems to be some Luka, LeBron, like, deference. You know, it's like they're almost kind of like being too respectful of each other. I want to see if they get to the point where they just both let it rip. But, yeah, I think they've, you know, certainly it's boded well for them, just like the Jimmy Butler trade has boded well for the Warriors. I personally still like Oklahoma City to come out of the West, and I still like Denver a lot. But, yeah, I think these playoffs are going to be awesome. I mean, to me, both conferences are pretty open.
Well, you're on a roll with predictions, so I'm writing that down.
Who we taking?
Every once in a while.
Great stuff, KC.
Thanks, KC.
Thanks, guys. Have a good weekend, man.
You too.
That is KC Johnson. Always a delight.
That's good stuff.
To him, yeah.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it. That's why I go for a five-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or whenever my favorite team is playing late. Five-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before tip-off.
Nerds. Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Life comes with big money questions. Are target date funds a smart or lazy way to invest? Should you pay off debt or invest extra cash? Can you deduct your dog as a home security system on your taxes? NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast has the answers. Their finance journalists break down investing strategies, tax planning, and smart ways to build wealth and navigate big financial decisions. Work smarter, not harder, on your finances this year. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
StreetEasy asked former New Yorkers if there's anything they miss about life in New York City.
Let me put it this way. House with a home theater sounds appealing. but that's until you realize you no longer have a theater district.
Whether you're looking to rent or it's time to buy, StreetEasy has the local expertise you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. StreetEasy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
Ugh, your clothes are too tight, yet you can't lose weight, even though you've tried so many diets. The reason you're having trouble losing weight could be a liver clogged with fat, and that is slowing your metabolism. Introducing Omicid, a natural superfood protein shake that uses natural amino acids and bioactive peptides to help unclog your liver and optimize your metabolism, so it's easier to lose weight, and it's been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. Find out more and see the university studies at omicid.com. That's AlmaSed.com.
Listen, I love the Twins and I love Minnesota because they were where I came up from and always have a great piece of me, but I want the White Sox to be great, man. And if these brothers can come in and buy a larger piece and help up the payroll and pay players and make this team and organization a better thing, then you know what? Let's go, baby, because Jerry's not going to, as much as this pains me to say, you know, Jerry's not going to own the team forever. And at some point, you know, these guys come in and buy it. And we talked about this today on FT. I think they'd be the second richest owners in baseball behind Stevie Cohen. So, hey, let's go. They can start buying players and buying the superstars we need to win in today's game. Yes. Yes, please. You know what they're going to become? What the Cubs should become, a powerhouse in the Central.
Might want to reel that back in a little bit. AJ Pierzynski talking about the prospects of Justin Ishbia and maybe with some involvement of his brother Matt, putting themselves in a position to perhaps take over the White Sox once Jerry Reinsdorf eventually decides to sell or after he sheds his mortal coil. Here to talk about that is Sam Koppelman, who is on Twitter at Sammy Koppelman. He's the publisher of Hunter Brook Media, which is in and of itself its own kind of cool business and journalism story. Sammy is also with us on twitch.tv/Chicago670 The Score. How are you, Sam?
Doing pretty well. How are you all?
Good. Tell me if I have this right, first of all, that Hunter Brook Media, as a part of the larger Hunter Brook business, is the journalistic arm of a hedge fund that allows you, through data journalism for of publicly available information, to find market inequities, to actually be the research arm that informs either short or long investments in companies. Is that about right?
It's about right. I run the Hunter Brook Media side of the business. So we've got a newsroom with journalists, former Intel folks, and their job is to go look at the wide world of publicly available information to go break interesting news stories. And then sometimes we share those stories with Hunter Brook Capital, which can take positions in the market. Other times we just publish them. Sometimes we end up working with other organizations to bring litigation against the companies. But I think you have me on because the story that we launched with last year was about Matt Ishbia.
Yeah, not only a great story about Matt Ishbia, but I listened to the podcast with you and Pablo Torres talking about
just what type of person and businessman Matt Ishbia is, and that's obviously relative to us here in Chicago, because the word on the street is Justin Ishbia is on deck in terms of taking over the White Sox whenever Jerry Reinsdorf decides to sell said team after he pulled out of, and this is Ishbia, Justin Ishbia pulled out of his attempt to buy the Minnesota Twins. So can you just kind of explain to the people Matt Ishbia and what type of owner you believe him to be based on what you've been able to dig up?
Sure. So I will say at the outset that my investigation focused on Matt Ishbia, not Justin Ishbia, right, though they're brothers and they work together. And I think it makes sense that a lot of people in Chicago are excited that you might have someone with these kind of deep pockets taking over a team. People in Phoenix were pretty excited too when Matt Ishbia took over the Suns. And we can dig into that a little bit. But I'd say to a sports audience, if you've seen how Ishbia has run the Suns, win now at all costs, mortgage away the future if you need to, that is emblematic of the move fast and break things approach we found Ishbia and his company had embarked on in the mortgage sector. Happy to share specifically what we found on that. But I'd say that in my view, paying Bradley Beal $50 million a year, not even close to the worst thing Matt Ishbia has done.
Well, the stuff that the details of United Wholesale Mortgage and the making, you know, sort of dragooning these supposedly independent mortgage brokers into these loyalist feeder positions was remarkable and nefarious in its success. It's amazing. Yeah. The takeaway for me was how venal all of these people were, how easily they were co-opted with money.
Yeah, so to give your listeners a bit of color on the story, essentially there's two ways you can get a mortgage. You can like go to the bank and get a mortgage. That's called a retail mortgage. Or you can go through the wholesale channel, which means you go and hire an independent mortgage broker. And the whole gag of that is you hire an independent mortgage broker and they'll go look across dozens of lenders to go find you the best deal for you. And UWM, the Ishbia's company, claimed that they sourced 100% of the mortgages, 100% of the mortgages where they were the lender, and they're the biggest mortgage lender in the country. They said that 100% of the mortgages came from supposedly independent mortgage brokers who, you know, had looked around for the best option and chosen UWM. And then we did this big data analysis, and what we found was there were thousands of brokers who were sending essentially all their business back to UWM, despite the advertisements that the company had made to the contrary. And, you know, it is sort of the brass knuckle bruiser approach to running a company that you can understand folks wanting in a sports owner, someone who's just going to do whatever it takes to win. The problem is, it doesn't necessarily demonstrate incredible understanding of risk reward over the long term. And I do think when you look in Phoenix, I mean, this is a team with Kevin Durant and Devin Booker, and they're the 11 seed. They don't have any picks for a really long time. You can kind of understand what this disposition and approach ultimately means for the fans or shareholders or other folks who are betting on the Ishbias to bring them to the promised land.
So Justin Ishbia has a board position with UWM. I don't know where on the masthead he is relative to Isaiah Thomas, who also has a role there, of course. Yikes. But Justin Ishbia is more involved in his private equity firm, Shore Capital Partners. He's got a legal background. From the research that you did on Matt, where does Matt end and Justin begin and vice versa business-wise?
It seems like Justin has a bona fide successful business career independent from United Wholesale Mortgage. We did not do deep scrutiny of Justin's business. Obviously, there's folks who live around where Justin was hoping to build a big house who have had some problems. That's not my specific story. I'm sure other people have covered that. But you know, our understanding is that United Wholesale Mortgage was a family business. Matt's dad ran it. Justin and Matt are both involved. And I think that, you know, when you look at the Phoenix Suns, which both of them play a role in, I think you can see the way that the two are a tag team, befitting the WWE.
I just wonder if Justin is as much of a red ass as his brother.
put simply.
I can't comment on the red assery,
unfortunately. I mean, Matt just seems easily peeved and sort of operating at this high sort of arousal level. I don't know if Justin's wired similarly.
In interviews, Justin has seemed to have a bit more equanimity, I would say. Okay. But I don't know what he's like behind closed doors. You know, we had that voicemail that we found that Matt Ishbia had left one of his sort of close friends in the mortgage industry. One of his loyalists, as it were, about Dan Gilbert, where, you know, he was like, we took him down. I'm not going to use the words. They're not.
Not on these airwaves.
Not using them. But, you know, I don't know if Justin has the same, let's call it verve, in his approach to these things. But look, I understand the hope, and I have no doubt that these folks are going to spend a lot of money as long as they've got a lot of money to spend. Although, of course, NBA ratings are down. These guys took out a big loan to be able to buy the Phoenix Suns. They bought it at a more expensive valuation than Cuban sold the Dallas Mavericks significantly, and the NBA's ratings have only gone down since. So I wonder just how deep the pockets really are, but I don't know. I haven't done deep reporting.
And Sam, that's what I was going to ask you about. It seems like with this ultra-aggressive approach on the front end, you're leaving yourself somewhat vulnerable on the back end, whether you're Matt Ishbia buying the Suns or if Justin Ishbia operates anywhere near that level, same would apply to him buying the White Sox.
Yes. Although I will say the Ishbias have a bit more cash than they did when I was on Pablo Torre's podcast because Matt Ishbia started selling his shares of UWM over the last bunch of months.
Interesting.
I don't know if Justin's been part of those same sales. But, you know, it's a high-risk, high-reward situation for the teams, and it's a bunch of high-risk, high-reward guys. I'm curious what the attitude is in Chicago. Are folks as sort of deluded as I am with James Dolan and the Knicks, where it's like, if you got a rich owner, something should work out at some point, you know? They'll spend the money. And then you end up with Isaiah Thomas running the team and, you know, Eddie Curry being paid just ungodly sums of money. And then you ask where all the money went and where your childhood hopes and dreams disappeared to.
That was dark quick.
It's not like the Knicks disenchanting me has stayed with me for years and years.
It's a core aspect of my psyche.
It's not like
you don't hear any of that.
But Sam, at least they're beating elite teams now. That's what I hear. They're beating a lot of elite teams, right? The Knicks this year, they have a very good record against the elite teams.
The Knicks are like they're like the Globetrotters against the Generals. Like if you got a bad team out there, the Knicks are pretty good. But yeah, the second you've got another team that knows how to play even a little bit of defense, it's a complete disaster. Although, of course, as a Knicks fan, I'm perpetually stuck in a place of diluted hope. Like, I think it's all going to come together. Mitchell's just getting warmed up, you know. Cat is injured. When everyone's healthy, watch out, Celtics.
Hey, Sam, you know the story of the CFO of the Sphere who quit right in front of Dolan's desk? I don't know if you saw that New York Post story who said, I won't be talked to that way and I don't want to work for you anymore and just left. Well, that was one of my best high school friends. So,
no way.
Yeah. So
I got to read that story.
It's crazy. And everything that is in that story is only describing everything very, very gently as to what actually happened. But there's fascinating stuff in there. That's quite a situation. Let me be a devil's advocate here.
Sure.
I would say that if you took the power of Hunter Brook Media and all those brains and all those minds, and you turned your guns on any owner of any major sports team, there would be at least something unsavory. That the fact anybody who's rich enough to own a sports team is probably enough of a carpetbagger or robber baron or involved in something at the very least kind of gross. So is this, am I being cynical?
I mean, look, my experience with sports owners is personal with James Dolan and professionally I've scrutinized Ishbia closely. And obviously in both cases, what turned up was a story much messier than the one that you'd read on their Wikipedia page or official bio. And obviously, there's no shortage of executives across the NBA, the NFL, with deeply checkered histories and flawed business practices. What I'll say is particularly notable about the Ishbias is the idea. I think an idea you'd imagine would come from someone in the mortgage sector, that you could just bet huge right now, gamble, hoping that eventually you'll be able to pay that down. And, you know, you'd think that as mortgage lenders, they'd understand how that story sometimes ends. But in this case, it's almost seems like a preternatural desire to win as much as possible, as soon as possible, without much regard for what that means in the long run. And I do think that you can do a close reading of the Phoenix Suns and see that the way that Ishbia has led that team is not the way that every owner leads every team, including every super wealthy owner. This is an impatience, a desire to just make it happen right away, that I have not seen in many public company CEOs, and I haven't seen in many sports teams. And so I really can't speak to Justin Ishbia, and I hope for the people of Chicago that he is a great owner who's willing to spend and to do so thoughtfully. But in the case of Matt Ishbia, I think that if Phoenix Suns fans were initially annoyed by our article, and I know at least some of them were, by now I think they're probably looking at it for some catharsis and understanding, as a bit of a Rosetta Stone as to what he's been doing to their team.
I feel like there's delineation to be made here, not only between the two brothers as potential sports owners, but I think what might work, and correct me if I'm wrong here, even if they have a very aggressive attitude from a business standpoint, when you talk about the NBA versus Major League Baseball, those are two very different sports where it does take time. It's hard to just go out and try to buy a championship, if you will. And I think that might be the saving grace. You can invest a lot more in, say, the minor leagues, the way you're developing players, the international pool of players as well. In addition to free agency, yes, and making trades, as we saw Matt Ishbia do, trying to create this super team.
Basically, impatience is way more dangerous in baseball.
Yes, because wreck will be so evident to everyone immediately, as opposed to basketball, where you can say, oh, it'll just take a season for them to get their act together. New head coach, new front office, new this, new that. Baseball, it's a long play.
Interesting. I'm curious your take. Isn't it also the case, though, that baseball has fewer salary cap restrictions?
For the next 2 seasons.
Yeah, give it 2 years. There's going to be at least, by the time they get done with this lockout, I think there's going to be some semblance, I don't know how hard or soft, but some semblance of a salary band.
But go back to your point, Sam. So if this happens, this changing of hands of ownership in the next 2 years before said lockout, are you asking that question because there is no salary cap? He could indeed go so big with the initial spin to fill up a ballpark, and that would be the danger there.
Well, you could imagine that in baseball, there'd actually be a real opportunity to just spend and, you know, pay off some free agents the highest possible number with the biggest possible contracts in a way where with the NBA, that's more difficult. But if that's changing in 2 years, then perhaps it's not much of a saving grace after all.
Sam, on the podcast, you delved a bit into what the legality or illegality is of some of the UWM practices. And one concern that I would have would be if, in fact, Ishbia is planning on taking over the White Sox one way or another, if he could be derailed by actual legal problems, is there a risk that he has exposure as a 22% owner of UWM? I guess maybe in this administration, there's no risk at all because they're dismantling all of the oversight anyway. But would there be a risk of him facing some sort of legal penalty for any involvement?
I am not a lawyer. Famously in my home, my fiance is at Harvard Law School, very proud. I am not a lawyer. I'd have to ask her what ultimately happens here. What I can say is that a national class action RICO case was brought against UWM with much of the information from our reporting being a part of that case. The case has not been adjudicated yet. It's in the courts. We'll see what happens. But obviously, in the event that we're right and UWM's practices are not just immoral, but potentially violative of laws, regulations, that could obviously be a hairy couple years for the Ishbias.
This is really fascinating stuff, and I could spend a lot more time than we have talking about it, but I really appreciate you being generous with your time today. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thanks for having me on. And the Knicks are going to win, right? It's all going to be okay?
Around. Maybe.
No, the Tom Thibodeau experience here in Chicago was, by the time they get to the playoffs, guys are
tired, are worn
throwing
down
up in garbage cans and asking to go to sleep.
Yes, this does seem like it might be our fate, but still hopeful. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sam.
Sam Koppelman, publisher of Hunter Brook Media.
Hey, it's Jim Costa with Cash the Ticket. Mike Valeni and I are all over the tournament again this March. Breakdowns of every region and every game, who are the Cinderellas, and which team's cutting down the nets. Subscribe and listen to Cash the Ticket on the Odyssey app, wherever you get your podcasts.
Olin Krutz, Score football analyst.
Bias towards offensive line. By that I mean find you an excuse of why an offensive lineman missed the block or why their job is hard.
Chicago Bears legend, six-time Pro Bowl center.
You talk about one of the greatest leaders I've ever been around. From football to the weight room to life, now he's in radio and he has the same passion.
Olin Krutz, every week with Mully and Haw. He probably doesn't like you, but he loves to talk Bears with Mully and Haw.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score. Mark Grody is in for Mully today. Good morning to our Chicago Sports Network audience and the simulcast till 9 o'clock. Thanks for joining us this morning. It's time now to go out to the Score Hotline brought to you by Aturo, your all-weather tire, Aturo.com, where we find Olin Krutz. Good morning, Olin. How are you?
Krutzy.
Morning. Good morning, guys. How's it going, man?
Doing well. Busy week up at Hallis Hall. The Bears are making big news, Olin, and you are the guy who a lot of people have been waiting to hear from. So let's just start there. After having days of back-to-back trades for Jonah Jackson and Joe Tooney, what's your reaction to how the Bears have attacked this offensive line problem?
Obviously, you pull up a chair a little bit and see what the Bears are up to. And Ryan Poles is going after guys who have proven on film in the NFL that they can play in the NFL, that they can make the blocks that are required to get the Chicago Bears to where they have to go. And they throw assets at this offensive line, which we've talked about a lot, that when are you going to start putting money into this offensive line? Jonah Jackson, really good player from the Lions when he was there, right? Joe Tooney, a guy who carries a lot of respect around the NFL. Anybody you talk to, really excited about this guy leading the Chicago Bears, the kind of football player, the kind of man he is, to put in that locker room to show guys what winning looks like. So it's like reassuring to me, guys, that the Chicago Bears are saying, look, we have a problem here. We have to put guys into this offensive line room to get it moving in the right direction. Let all these guys compete for all these jobs that they have there that are open to protect the young quarterback who took way too many sacks last year, whether it be who you blame on those sacks, him, the offensive line. I think they're both responsible for that. But just to see Ryan Poles go out, get guys like Jonah Jackson, like Joe Tooney. It's exciting for the Chicago Bears and their fans. We know that this offensive line needed to be fixed this offseason.
One of the best parts about Joe Tooney, Olin, is his durability. He's missed two games in the last 9 years. Is that just luck or is that part of professionalism as well?
I think you know the answer to that, Grody. That's professionalism, right? That's a guy who gets his body ready for the season. That's a guy who, even though he hasn't missed a game, I'm sure he's played through some injuries. He's played through some things that a lot of guys wouldn't play through. So that's the kind of guy Joe Tooney is when you put up those kind of stats where you've only missed two games, right? And obviously, he's played in a bunch of Super Bowls. He's played in a bunch of playoff games. He knows what it looks like. He knows what winning looks like. Now you have a guy sitting there in your room who guys stand up and they watch him and they say, okay, this is the way a pro carries himself. This is the way a guy acts who has been successful in the NFL. He starts to set the standard, starts to set the example for these young offensive linemen as far as every day taking care of your body, every day showing up to work, showing up to walk through, taking everything seriously, concentrating, guys, on the things that the Chicago Bears players talked about so much last year, concentrating on the details, concentrating on little things, concentrating on getting your culture moving in the right direction. A guy like Joe Tooney can help with that a lot.
Olin, for historical context, it doesn't always apply, but sometimes going back, it does. You have an example where it does kind of fit. And I wonder if this is one of those times. In 2004, new coach Lovie Smith, his first offseason heading into his first year, they went out and they signed John Tate from the Kansas City Chiefs to an offer sheet. He was a restricted free agent, I believe. They structured the contract so the Chiefs couldn't match it. John Tate comes and was the anchor to an offensive line that had some good pieces, but maybe he helped stabilize that offensive line in a way that it wasn't before. Do you see a parallel there? And how important is it maybe for an offensive line to have that one guy that is as dependable as Joe Tooney seems to be?
Yeah, I mean, you talk about that offensive line, right, David, and you talk about how many guys Jerry Angelo actually hit on, right, that came in and helped us. You talked about John Tate, great football player, man, and like you're saying, solidified the left tackle position for us for years there. And just like the kind of guy you're talking about, came from the Chiefs, a lot of success in that offense in those days with Priest Holmes and all the guys, Gonzalez and all the guys they had there playing for the Kansas City Chiefs. And then you talk about Reuben Brown, right? And then you talk about Roberto Garza, and then they signed my good friend Fred Miller in 2005. And that offensive line was a very, very good offensive line, guys. And we talk about and Reuben and Fred, both 32 years old, right? Both a little older. And John Tate would probably be more of an example of like Jonah Jackson, still in his prime, still a young guy who could go out there and dominate football games, right? Go out there and physically oppose his will on other teams. So they get two guys there kind of in a different part of their career. We understand Joe Tooney is coached by Dante Scarnecchia out there in New England, and then coached by former left tackle for the Chicago Bears, Andy Hecht, out there for the Chiefs. Two really good coaches. You know, the thing you wonder about with Joe, obviously, is he's only played he played with two Hall of Fame quarterbacks, right? That helps, yeah, obviously. But look, his pass pro is really, really good. His film is really, really good, guys, when you watch the guys play. And then he moves to left tackle for his team. We know he's not a left tackle, man. He goes out there, fights every week, does whatever his team needs to win football games. The one year he didn't have a Hall of Fame quarterback, obviously the Patriots went 7-9. So it's not only Joe Tooney who fixes everything, right? You got to have all the pieces to the puzzle to win football games. But like we're talking about with Roberto Garza, with Fred Miller, with John Tate, with Reuben Brown, you start to add pieces to the puzzle and you hit on them. And you hit on them and this offensive line gets moving in the right direction. It's just good to see them throw assets into that room, a little bit of money into the offensive line room, and see what shakes out.
I am glad that you would consider Fred Miller a good friend, first of all.
Of course.
I just wanted to make sure that I got that out there. What else, Olin? Is this enough? I mean, you get Joe Tooney, you got Noah Jackson.
No.
Okay,
no.
Jonah Jackson, tell me more.
No, it's not enough. I think you keep adding assets to that room. Look, you almost had to, you know, there's the positive side to this, to these signings, right? We like that we went out and got Joe Tooney, a guy who can show you what winning looks like. Ted Washington did that for us, you know, back in 2001. We signed Blake Brockmeyer from the Carolina Panthers, another guy, free agent, went and got Reuben Brown. Showed us a lot about what winning looks like. I'm glad you got Joe Tooney, but you almost have to manufacture the culture. You almost have to manufacture these guys, bring them from other buildings and put them in your building, right? Darnell Wright can learn from these football players who are coming in to show you how to be a pro. So no, it's not enough. You got to get young guys in that room, guys that you develop, Chicago Bears guys who have been here their whole career, who can help you down the line with your culture. So you keep bringing in, keep adding pieces, man. Keep putting assets into that room. You never know what hits, what doesn't hit. Remember, Roberto Garza signed for only 1 year. He had that knee problem. The Baltimore Ravens tried to sign him, right? He failed the physical. We brought him here. You know, Chris Ballard vouched for him. Chris Ballard, the Colts general manager. And then he became a good Chicago Bear, a legendary Chicago Bear, a really good football player. So keep adding guys to that room. Keep getting guys in that room who can compete for jobs. I think Howie Roseman, you guys might know him, he won the Super Bowl this year. He said you can never have enough O-linemen and D-linemen in your building. Keep putting guys in that room.
talking to Olin Kreutz here on the Score. Mark Grody in for Mully today. Olin, if they were to ask you your advice about what direction to go now at the center position, if you had A, draft a young guy, put him between two veterans and let him see how that works. B, go out and overpay Drew Dahlman in free agency, because that's what happens in free agency, and that's just the reality of the NFL. But to get a guy as stable as he might be, it would be worth it. Or C, stay with Coleman Shelton now that you have a guy that has experience in Chicago, in your building, and might be respected by the offensive line. A, B, or C, which would you lean toward?
Yeah, you go out there and you have to fix that center position also, right? And you can't have everything, obviously, in offensive line room. But I would lean towards a younger guy with the two guys you just got, right? I mean, Dahlman, it depends what Coach Roshar wants. When he turns on the film, Coach Roshar, now the Bears' offensive line coach, when he turns on the film, when him and Ben Johnson sitting in the room up there at Hallis Hall, and Ben Johnson asks him, Coach Roshar says, what do you want here at this position? Do you want an outside zone guy? Do you want a power guy? We're coming downhill at people. What do you want on film from your center, directing traffic, getting guys moving in the right direction? Now you got Joe Tooney there. He can help with that. He can help guys get guys on the right blocks, identify who the offensive line is working to, who the running back is working to, who's coming, who's hot. All these things you got to work on. I would like to see them get a young center and maybe also bring in a veteran center, like when the Bears drafted me and I sat behind Casey Wigman for a year and learned a lot from Casey Wigman about how to be a pro, how to study my book. I sat behind him and really needed that year to learn. Talked about Cam Jurgens. He just did that in Philadelphia, right? The Eagles just did that with him. I sat him behind Jason Kelce for a year, played him at right guard, and then he started, and then they won the Super Bowl with him at center. So keep adding guys to that room, David. Maybe you get both. I don't know if you have the money from Dahlman. I don't know if you, with the inside side three now, you might want to get an older left tackle in there too, a guy who's well-respected around the league, a guy who can block people, you know, with the injuries you have at the tackle position. So much uncertainty in this offensive line room. I don't know if you can ever say this year, oh, that's enough, we're good to go, here we go, get him on the field, right? Jonah Jackson, they just gave him a bunch of money to go to the Rams, and you worry about, okay, why they let him go so fast? People are dying to have guys who block people in their 20s, guys who are 28 years old. I love Jonah Jackson's film there in Detroit, but it was between Frank Ragnow, an all-pro center, and Taylor Decker, a very good left tackle. The sum of the parts on the offensive line is always the most important thing. Nobody on the offensive line is good by themselves.
There is nothing more ridiculous than anybody thinking to themselves, yeah, the Bears are good on the offensive line. They're fine. They signed these two. They got Joe Tooney and Jonah Jackson. They're good. So that said, I'm taking a jump ahead here, because let's just say you got Tooney, you get Jonah Jackson. Let's say they sign somebody maybe not as significant as those two in free agency. Olin, at number 10 in the draft, are you about offensive line there as well? Do we continue to pile on there, or do you go defense here? And I know, and we're all allowed to change our minds here, but at this moment, what are you thinking about that?
I think at number 10, you take the best available player, right? I always think in the first round, guys, in those early picks, man, you got to take a guy who you know is going to be a Chicago Bear for 10 years. You got to take a guy, a difference maker. You got to take a guy that you really like there, who Coach Ben Johnson and Ryan Poles look at and say, this is the number one guy on our board right now, where they, you know, I think they have three picks in the top 50. So they have picks to get there, to get guys in that Chicago Bears. But obviously, you know me, guys, if I'm in a room, I'm arguing for the number one offensive lineman on the board, right? I'm going to put him, and that's all you're going to hear from me. The only thing you hear from me if I was in the Chicago Bears is somebody run power O and somebody draft an offensive lineman. Let's sign more offensive linemen. Let's keep building that room up. But in there, when you are in charge of the whole football team, you have to do what's best for the organization at Chicago Bears. And when you're sitting there at 10, you got to take the absolute guy that you know is going to be a Chicago Bear for 8 to 10 years and help you win a lot of football games.
You make a great point about Jonah Jackson in Detroit. He did benefit from playing between two really solid, above average, become dominant offensive linemen. I wonder, now that you have him in the mix, he had played left guard. He had experience at center. Didn't go so well with the Rams. And with Joe Tooney here, maybe he is a guy you plug in at right guard. How difficult of a transition would it be to switch sides of the ball if you are Jonah Jackson? And do you think that he is a possibility at center?
I think Jonah Jackson is a possibility, David. I think that's why the Rams maybe didn't like what they saw from him because they put him at center, right? So I think you put him at left guard and you forget about that position. I think you put Jonah Jackson there, young guy, has showed you that he could play left guard. Like I said, man, I loved his film when he was a free agent. I was hoping the Bears might take a look at him when he came, when he left the Lions. But now he's here as a Chicago Bear. I think he's 20. I think he's 28 or 29 years old. Plug him in there. Plug him in there at left guard. That's what you know he plays well. Joe Tooney has showed you, man. He can play left tackle. I think he played a little right guard. He probably could play center if he wanted to. I think you put him at right guard and you figure the center position out. But I wouldn't mess with Jonah Jackson too much. I think he's a left guard. I think you put him there. You leave him there. I think that's what his film says. I think his film last year says that he's probably not a center. Remember now, when he played center last year, he played for Matthew Stafford. And Matthew Stafford does what? He makes all the calls. He identifies everything. He tells you who's coming. He tells you who's blitzing. He tells you who you should be blocking, right? So if you struggle at center with Matthew Stafford, I do worry about moving him to center a little bit with Caleb Williams.
The acquisitions, Golan, of Joe Tooney and Jonah Jackson actually get me more excited about guys like Karan Amagaji, because now there's breathing room and maybe not the expectation, although there should be expectation considering he was a third-round pick. Where does Karan Amagaji fit in all of this? And do you see a future for this guy, not only with the Bears, but in the NFL from what you saw last year?
Yeah, young football player who moves really well, right? Got great feet for his size, got great arm length, has a lot to learn about football, obviously. Where does he fit in? He fits it in the room, right? You put him in that room, he's going to be here. You drafted him just last year, right? He's got to develop his game. He's got to get his strength back from that quad tendon injury he had in college. He's got to work through that, get power back in the league, get on Coach Roshar's radar, talk to him about what you think you have to improve on, how you can get your game better, find guys to watch on film, keep improving your game, and add yourself to the mix there, right? So that's where he fits in right now, where he is competing for whatever job you have open. And then he could probably play guards, tackle positions. But right now, he's just got to get his body right, get strong, get healthy, and then work on your technique. And then when you get to camp, you're ready to compete for whatever position they want you to compete for.
Olin, you know as well as anybody about the dynamics in any NFL building, but especially how it's all between the head coach and the general manager. When you have a new head coach making what Ben Johnson is making, $13 million a year, the assumption is that he's got all the clout. He's going to be the most powerful man in the organization. What did these moves tell you about the working relationship between Poles and Ben Johnson? Is this, on one hand, you've got a guy that played for Ben Johnson and Jonah Jackson, and they went out and identified him and they got him. And on the other, you've got Joe Tooney, who Ryan Poles was familiar with in Kansas City. But let's face it, I don't think you have to have that connection to realize that Joe Tooney is all about winning and a guy that is worth trying to get. What does what do the last 2 days tell you about the relationship and working rapport between those two guys?
It tells me they sat down and said, we got to get some things fixed in this room right here, right? They watched all the film, poured over it, put Coach Roshar in there with them, probably called Coach Roshar in their office and said, look, we got to fix this offensive line. Take a look at these two guys. I think their working relationship, David, like you're talking about, is this is what I think needs to get fixed on this football team. How are we going to get that done? Let's go out and get it. Let's go out and pour assets into the offensive line room, get this thing moving in the right direction. Let's get a young guy who has shown that he can play at a Pro Bowl level, and let's get an older guy who's still playing at a pretty damn high level, who also knows what winning looks like, who can help us lead that room, who can help everybody moving in the right direction for what winning actually looks like. And Grody knows better than anybody. Those players talked about that a lot last year, right? Whether it be on the 50 million podcasts they do or every time they did an interview, they talked about how the coaches weren't holding the standard, keeping them moving in the right direction, concentrating on details. That's what we heard a lot about. Put a guy like Joe Tooney in that room, and all of a sudden you got a guy who says, look, this is what it looks like, though. I know we can talk about it, but this is exactly what it looks like when a football team is heading in the right direction to win football games. Guys playing a lot of Super Bowls. It just tells me, David, that these two guys were in lockstep in that building, that the offensive line needed assets in that room to compete for the jobs that they have.
Should the Bears have 7 captains again this year, Olin?
If they could get a few O linemen and D linemen in there, it'd be nice. So you can have 7, but let's get a few linemen in there, a few guys who, I always say, guys, the farther you get away from the football, the farther you get away from football, right? So those guys out there, the receivers and the DBs, when they talk and they do all those kind of things, that's because they don't really have to hit everybody on every play. The guys in the middle, man, the guys in the box.
Yeah.
Those are the guys that you want leading your football team, the quarterback, the middle linebacker, the center, the tackle, the nose guard, the defensive end, the defensive tackle. Those are the guys you want leading your football team every day, showing them what things look like.
Before we let you go, Olin, quickly, I always wonder every year during the combine what you think as you observe it. What do any impressions left by this year's combine, and how much stock do you put in the underwear Olympics, is what Dustin calls it?
It's always interesting to watch the drills and the things that everybody's doing. I always think to myself, these guys are amazing athletes. I'm sure you guys think that too. Some of it seems like a waste of time. You know, I know the medicals are extremely important. It's good to see all the guys out there competing, running. I'm always just mostly, David, amazed by the athletes that a lot of these guys are, and the fact that even though they're athletes, some of them won't make it because there's so much more to making the NFL than just running and jumping and doing cone drills like you guys know. I don't have to tell you guys that, but
hell yeah.
Anything football, I'm very, very interested in it. And I always enjoy the combine, seeing those guys compete at different drills and the way they work and the way they go through things, and just seeing, you know, guys 6'7", 340 running 4.8s and 4.9s. Just amazing to me.
Olin, we got to run here, but really quickly, if Joe Tooney was to do a podcast, would you listen to the Joe Tooney podcast?
Every day with Tooney. You know, I would, because look, I do radio.
Yeah.
I do analyst work,
and it
would give me something to talk about. Like, you know, Grody, when you're doing radio, when you're doing a four-hour pregame show, anything helps.
Oh, anything helps. Absolutely.
Tuned in with Tooney. There we go.
Boom. I like the way you guys are talking.
Olin, thanks a lot for your time. Great insight.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Olin Kreutz.
Spiegel and Holmes.
Bob Costas.
Matt, thank you very much. And Lawrence, stop dominating the conversation the way you have over the last several minutes, really.
Afternoons on the Score.
Leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, especially if you are a fan of the Seth Jones trade. We're going to do the Jones stuff in the later half of the show. Mario did a great job breaking it down in the pregame. I was at the Tom Segura concert at United Center, and I got a text from Greg Boysen saying, of course they trade Seth Jones on your night off. And I laughed, thinking it was a joke. And I said, I better check my phone just to make sure Greg's not joking.
Just in case.
And he wasn't. He was not joking.
Yeah.
So I got to see the second and third periods here, and it was exciting.
Jay Zawoski out with us celebrating our guy Rick Camp as Campy gets married at the end of the month. We're all at the Tom Segura concert.
And Rick Camp in studio.
Well, he's not here now, but Jay then had to go to his studio over at CHGO and get reaction to the Seth Jones trade.
How was Tom Segura, Jay Zawoski, with Tanny and with Lawrence and with Campy and more?
Everything with those guys is amazing and fun. But I'd never seen Segura before. I just saw him on social media and stuff like that, and never seen him do stand-up before. It was great. Really, really funny. I've never been to a comedy show in a venue that size before.
Yeah, me
neither. Very impressed with the production. The sound quality was Tannehill level.
That's good.
Well, it was outstanding.
We were talking about that because Tom had a DJ, and I was sitting there going, that should be Tanny's gig. Being the DJ for like the Tom Segura show.
Don't fire him. We like him in this job.
I mean, it's a weekend thing whenever he comes to town. It's not like.
It should be a side gig.
Though. Yeah, it's a side hustle.
Segura probably tours with that dude, though.
I would imagine. If that were to happen for our brother, Chris Tannehill, I'd be happy for him, too.
He's got a family and a radio show. He's not available for such things.
Wow.
I'm sorry. I'm going to take control.
We were so surprised, by the way, that Chris DiStefano opened for Tom Segura. Like, that was like we said he had an opener, and then like they're like, oh yeah, Chris DiStefano's here. We're like, whoa, we all sat up in our chairs, had a good time with Chrissy Humble Park.
Well, look, Jay, you know I'm the hockey guy of this four pack here. Like, long
everyone
time.
Everyone knows that.
Everybody,
are you?
Yeah, yep. Long time hockey guy. I watched 8 minutes of the game last night. No, but I'm like, we gotta talk to Jay today. because did they just get a starting goaltender of the future in getting rid of Seth Jones? And then the new guy has 41 saves and has like a this like emotional moment post-game where he says, I love you to the fans that he's never met before in his life. This felt like a thing, like a happening last night. Is it a turning point of the rebuild? Answer all seven of those questions, sir.
Yes, I'll tackle them one at a time.
Thank
we
you.
Have 8 minutes to do so. No, I would say, yes, it is a turning point in the rebuild because you feel good about your defensive prospects. You feel good about your forward prospects, especially considering you're probably going to draft one in the top three again this summer. They're going to be active in free agency and in the trade market. So this was kind of the final piece. And even before the game began, when Spencer Knight stepped on the ice for warmups, I think everyone's Seth Jones frustration came out in cheers for Spencer Knight. And look, Spencer Knight is a high-end goalie prospect. He's a first-round pick, which is rare in hockey. If I could equate it, it would be like a running back in football where only the elite of the elite get taken in the first round. Spencer Knight was one of those guys, and then as soon as the Florida Panthers draft him, they sign Sergei Bobrovsky as a free agent, and he's a Hall of Fame-level goalie. So Spencer Knight has to kind of be thinking, okay, well, I guess I'm not getting my chance here for some time. So I think despite going from defending Stanley Cup champion to the worst team in the league, Spencer Knight knows this is his chance, and he took advantage of it. He was absolutely awesome. The Hawks had no business winning that game last night. None. They should have lost that game 5-0, but he was amazing. And the difference it makes when your goalie makes saves they're not supposed to and what that does for the confidence of your teammates, it cannot be measured. Sure, you know, Soderblom's been good. Peter Mrazek, you look at him and say, okay, well, he typically makes the saves he's supposed to make. Sometimes you need more than that to get your team going. And Spencer Knight in the first period made 3 or 4, you know, 5-star saves on the LA Kings. And it was a difference in the game.
I can understand Seth Jones's frustration. Because when you look at the Hawks, and he would have a better view than the rest of us, you look at the Hawks, you go, this is going to be a while before this thing is really cooking in the way where I could contribute. And if you're a player that's looking at your career and saying, how long am I going to be this good, and do I want to waste it on teams that aren't good, I can understand it. I know that people are upset with Seth Jones. I thought that you had a really good tweet about it. Like, you know, there are a lot of people talking about Seth Jones, and they're going to be talking about him differently later on in this season.
Yeah, he's going to go to a winner. He's going to be put in a position where he can be a complimentary player as opposed to the do-it-all defenseman. And look, I don't want to get into it anymore. I've been saying on the CHGO Blackhawks show, like, we are, after Friday, we're no longer allowed to talk about Seth Jones because he's gone. He can't hurt us anymore. But he was a way better player than he got credit for being here. He was put in a position to do way more than he was supposed to. He was paid to do so. I will say that. $9.5 million. You should do it all. But I think that contract and his arrival indicating kind of this the decline of the Blackhawks, a lot of people just were out on Seth Jones from day one. It's a fresh start for him. He's going to thrive in Florida where he can just go play his game on a much better team. It's a win-win trade for everybody. I think Florida's happy. I think Chicago is very happy. And it has to be stated, like, Seth Jones told Kyle Davidson, I want to go to Dallas or Florida. And Dallas basically said, we can't make it work salary-wise, so we're out. So he had one team to trade with the Florida Panthers, and got an elite goaltending prospect with already NHL success behind him and a first-round pick. It is a masterclass from Kyle Davidson in this trade. And I think the people that have been doubting him lately because this season didn't go quite as well as people thought it might, most of his trades, most of his signings have worked out. Now this summer for him becomes massive because he's got to find that all-star level guy to play with Bedard.
This is why we wanted to talk to you. Big point in the rebuild. Kyle Davidson pulls off the trade. We will check the win-loss from here overall, and we'll look back and see if this is the moment. Thank you, Jay.
All right, happy Fat Tuesday, or as I call it, Tuesday.
Happy Fat Tuesday. Also, happy birthday to Chicago today as well.
Oh, yeah.
March 4th, yes. This is the city's birthday.
And CHGO, 3 years today.
That's right.
Happy birthday, Mike. Mike.
Happy birthday,
many,
Mike.
Many, many folks all thought we wouldn't make it this far. Shane?
Sorry. I'm sorry, Jay.
It's all right. We talked to that. We're good.
Yeah, but also maybe put more employees from your company on the softball team and not just two.
There it is.
All right. Well, we
have 13 people that work here.
Yeah. it's not a lot.
Hire more people.
Thanks, Jay.
Thanks, Jay.
Bye. Love you guys.
Love you.
Same. That is Jay Zawoski from CHGO. If you want hockey information, go to him. Don't go to Spiegs. When we come back.
How dare you, sir.
It's true. When we come back, Jason Leisure will talk about the newest acquisition, and we still didn't really talk about Jack Sanborn being non-tendered. We'll discuss that and more with Jason next on The Score.
A lot of opportunity here in Chicago. Really good farm system. A lot of interesting young players. Who's impressed you here in camp so far?
Yeah, I'd say everyone's been super impressive. I mean, it's my first experience with a bunch of major league guys. And so it's been super impressive to see everyone's work and see bits and pieces from everyone and see what they do well. I guess out of prospects, I really like working with Edgar Caro. I'm not sure if I'm pronounced his last name.
You got it right. Yeah. You
got future he's been cool. But yeah, everybody's been awesome. It's been really good to gel with those younger guys and see where they're at.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 670, The Score. That is the voice of Jim Callis. He's out at Sox camp talking to Braden Montgomery. And we're delighted to welcome Jim to the program. You know him, MLB Pipeline, the Marquee Sports Network. He is all places at all times. Jim, good morning. What a joy to talk to you. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Good to talk to you guys. It's my last day in Arizona, and it's pouring right now. I don't. It's not fair. It's torrential rain as I it's not torrential, but it's hard rain as I head to Hohokam Park this morning.
So as you get ready to leave Arizona, what was the lasting impression from Camelback Ranch and the White Sox? Was it their wealth of young pitching, or was it the kind of position talent that they infused with the trade? Because Braden Montgomery's is as charismatic of a young guy as you're going to see. He was a great interview.
No, he is. I'm going to say both because it was fortunate. Just coincidentally, the day I was in White Sox camp, Noah Schultz and Hagen Smith were both pitching in the big league game, went two innings each. They're the two best left-handed pitching prospects in baseball, but there's so much young position player talent. I mean, we knew about Colson Montgomery and Edgar Caro was here, and they just made the crochet trade and got Kyle Teal and Braden Montgomery and Chase Meidroth, and Chase will probably break camp with the team. You know, it's our new farm system rankings come out today, and the White Sox are sixth. They made the biggest improvement from a year ago when they were 20th of any team, and I know White Sox fans don't want to hear, hey, we got prospects coming, but they do. And you know, is it going to take a couple years? It will. But you are going to see a lot of these guys in the big leagues this year. And I do think when you look back at the Garrett Crochet trade, it's not going to just be the talent they got in the trade. I really think that Kyle Teal and Braden Montgomery, first and foremost, you traded because those guys were good players. But I think those two guys are going to be kind of setting the culture going forward. They're both great guys. I think that was a small piece of why they were specifically targeting that deal. And, yeah, I mean, 121 losses is not fun, but there is real optimism for the future.
Jim Callis is joining us on the Score Hotline, brought to you by Aturo, your all-weather tire, aturo.com. I saw where you wrote that that Hagen Smith, obviously the second of the two left-hand, and I just mean ranked behind Noah Schultz. They're the same age, the two great lefties. You wrote that he was the best pitcher out of the draft when the Sox drafted him, but they were also interested in the best hitter out of that draft, who you had as Braden Montgomery. So now they wind up with both the best hitter and the best pitcher out of that draft. Is that one of the, and I know Teal is thought of as, you know, a better prospect than Montgomery, but if he can hit like you believe he can, that could be one of the real good players to keep an eye on.
No, exactly. You know, Teal was probably the best catcher in his draft. He went, I think literally the pick before the White Sox picked where they got Jacob Gonzalez, Teal went 14th to the Red Sox. And, you know, Teal, yeah, I mean, what sticks out with Teal first and foremost is the offense. Like, he can hit, he's got some power, he controls the strike zone. He's also really athletic. I think his defense is a little underrated. Because he's been athletic, he hasn't been a full-time catcher, you know, for the last 6 or 7 years. And he does have room for improvement behind the plate. But it's not one of these deals where, oh, you're hoping he can catch. He'll be able to catch, and I think he'll be at least an average defender. But, yeah, I mean,
you know, you essentially, you know, got in that deal, all-star type catcher in Kyle Teal, Ray Montgomery, you know, classic right field profile. They may even let him try some center field a little bit. Chase Meidroth is, I think, in the long term, probably more of a reserve on a contender, but I think he might open the season as their shortstop. And, I mean, he's a really good contact hitter. That's kind of his thing. And even the fourth guy they got in the trade, Wilkelman Gonzalez. Wilkelman Gonzalez led the minors in strikeout rate in 2023. He's a little erratic. We'll see. Is he a starter? Is he a reliever? But it's legit stuff. So, you know, a lot of parallels, I think, to the Chris Sale trade. Same team, same four prospect package, two top 100 guys, you know, like they got. And, you know, whenever I say that, I get White Sox fans who are like, you know, I'm not sure the Chris Sale trade worked out. And I will say, with the Chris Sale trade, you know, maybe Moncada and Kopech weren't everything they were cracked up to be, but they did help the White Sox make back-to-back playoff appearances, and that's literally the only time that's ever happened in franchise history. So, you know, the Chris Sale trade repeating itself would not be a bad thing.
Jimmy said the White Sox are ranked sixth in the new MLB pipeline organizational rankings that will come out today. Where are the Cubs, and how would you evaluate what they have ahead of them this season in terms of guys being blocked and prospects who are really looking at maybe staying in the minors or being used as trade chips because they don't have spots on the major league roster?
Yeah, and I mean, the Cubs are fascinating. They rank eighth in our farm system rankings, David. They have seven top 100 prospects. That's the most anybody has in baseball. They're tied with the Mariners. And the interesting thing is six of those guys either played in AAA or the majors last year. You know, Matt Shaw, Kay Horton, Owen Casey, James Triantos, Kevin Alcantara, and I've forgotten somebody off the top of my head. Moises Ballesteros. And, you know, the Cubs are in this weird spot where they haven't been to the playoffs since 2020. They haven't won a playoff game since 2017. So there's a lot of pressure to win. And they don't, you know, Kyle Tucker's their best player, but they, you know, it's a weird kind of mix of players where they don't have a bunch of stars. They don't really have any gaping holes on the team either. You know, Matt Shaw's going to get the chance to win the third base job, but you don't really have openings for all these guys unless you have some injuries. So whether it's trading some of these guys, it's trading some veterans, if that arises, you know, it's not just the Cubs are trying to win this year. They've kind of got to figure out, okay, which pieces are we keeping? And then the ones that we aren't keeping, you can't just let them stagnate in AAA. What are we trading them for? So I do have, in my mind, I do think the Cubs should be the favorites in NL Central. But it's going to be fascinating how they try to juggle. You kind of need to win now, but you also have to figure out how are we going to, you know, accommodate all these young players we have.
Jim, we asked the question this morning because the White Sox sent down five pitchers yesterday, just moved them to minor league camp. Noah Schultz and Hagen Smith, which of the two comes up faster? Which of the two makes their debut this year? Schultz, they've been careful with thus far. I don't think he's gone beyond the fourth inning. I think they had like a 65-pitch limit on him last year. Are they going to try to extend him a little bit more? Is Smith ready because he came out of college? Which, if you had to pick one, who makes it quicker?
I would pick Schultz. And you're right, he has got more in four innings. That's the question. They've handled him very carefully. His first year in pro ball in 23, neither was major, but he had a shoulder impingement and he had a flexor strain. They've been very cautious with him, and it's funny. I mean, look, they're not going to contend this year. There's no real need to rush anybody. Yeah. And like you said, he hasn't gone past the fourth inning. I don't even know. I think he's pitched roughly 100 innings as a pro, which is more than Hagen Smith. But he's so good, I don't know that you can really – like, you could say organizationally, okay, the plan is we'd like to get Noah 125 innings. You know, he was double-A Southern League Pitcher of the Year, so I think he's ready for Charlotte. But that kid is so good. It's not just stuff. I mean, he's 6'9". He throws from a low slot. He's got maybe the best slider in the minors. His fastball's legit. But he also has an advanced changeup. And for, I think he's, what, 21 years old, 6'9".
Yeah.
Incredible body control. He's always thrown a ton of strikes. I don't – outside of having him go deeper in games and work more innings in the season, there's not really much he needs to do developmentally. So I think we're going to see him. My guess is – they'll probably open the season in Charlotte, and I think toward
August or September, they're going to run out of challenges for him. So I think we'll see him. Hayden Smith has very good stuff also, a little bit less polish, even though he's coming out of college, less experience because he's barely pitched a pro ball. I think Hayden Smith is probably a 2026 guy. If this was different, this is a situation where the White Sox are trying to win this year, I could definitely see Hagen Smith with the quality of stuff coming up later in the year. But my guess is he'll probably open in AA, and they'll let him split the year between AA and AAA.
Jim, 30 seconds. Is Matt Shaw ready to be the everyday third baseman for the Cubs at the major league level?
I think he is. I have no doubt he'll at least be able to hit, say, 260 with 15 to 20 homers as a rookie. The bat's real. I don't know if you guys have ever spoken to him. Like, he's not going to be afraid. Like, he's not cocky, but he's very confident. He's a good hitter. You know, I think the defense is probably going to be a little bit more inconsistent than hitting. But, yeah, I do think he's ready.
Great stuff. Thanks a ton, Jim. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Jim. Stay dry.
Yeah, great talking to you guys. I will. It's still pouring. I'll try to stay dry.
That's Jim Gallus from MLB Pipeline, MLB.com, and, of course, the Marquee Network. Always
great
fun
stuff.
To talk to Jim.